You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the OECD unveil a new plan to get multinationals to pay taxes where they make money, rather than insisting that all their billions in profits were earned by their outlet on Grand Cayman. We'll ask if it will work. President Barack Obama signs an executive order bolstering America's virtual defences. We'll find out if the new measures will make the looting of the US Treasury by Nigerian spammers any less likely. As global laughter subsides at Iran's recent forays into simian space exploration and flightless stealth fighters, a reminder that not all of the Islamic Republic's technology is quite so hapless. As the IAEA returns to Iran, we'll chart Tehran's progress towards the bomb.
It's important to go beyond the idea that this is somehow an obligation and view it as a measure of an assurance that Iran could take to reassure the international community.
We'll speak to the author Will Storr about his new book, The Heretics, a chronicle of his travels among that large constituency of people whose beliefs are vexingly undaunted by facts. We'll also call Berlin to speak to Monocle's executive producer, Gillian DeBias, who's at the film festival, and we'll play some music too, including an excerpt from our recent Midori House session with Steve Earle. That's all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all of that, the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Local officials have said that a NATO airstrike has killed 10 Afghan civilians, including 5 children, in eastern Afghanistan today, a toll that, if confirmed, is likely to raise tension between President Hamid Karzai's government and US-led NATO forces. Meanwhile, NATO chief Anders Fogh Rasmussen has said that President Obama's announcement that half the US force in Afghanistan will be withdrawn by early next year is in keeping with NATO's handover of security to Afghan authorities by the end of 2014.
President Obama's announcement yesterday is in full accordance with the roadmap we have outlined. We will gradually hand over responsibility to the Afghans. That process will be completed by the end of 2014. So from now until the end of 2014, you will see a gradual drawdown of international troops.
Here, raids by British police and regulators on 2 companies suspected of selling horse meat as beef have exposed a Europe-wide scandal that has shocked consumers and exposed flawed food safety controls. A slaughterhouse in Yorkshire and a food processing plant in Wales were raided by police. Andrew Rose is the Director of Operations at the Food Standards Agency.
Well, what we found in our investigations is horse meat produced in a slaughterhouse in Yorkshire being shipped to a food business near Aberystwyth in West Wales, and that being used in a product which is meant to be beef and not horse. Clearly that's unacceptable, and we've seized all of the product in that location as well as all of the paperwork and any other evidence we need as part of our investigation.
A Tibetan youth dressed as a monk poured petrol over his body and set himself alight and chanted pro-Tibetan independence slogans at the Buddhanath temple in Kathmandu as an apparent protest against Chinese rule of his Himalayan homeland. The European Commission President Jose Manuel Barroso said today that the European Union and the United States were set to begin negotiating a groundbreaking free trade agreement.
I am delighted to announce today that the European Union and the United States have decided to initiate internal procedures to launch negotiations with the aim of reaching a groundbreaking free trade agreement, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. It will be a comprehensive agreement going beyond tariffs by integrating markets and removing barriers.
The mysterious death of an Australian prisoner in Israel has put the spotlight on a military-run censorship system there. ABC Australia claimed that the dead man, Ben Zaidyeh, was a member of Israel's Mossad spy agency. According to an Israeli military report, he committed suicide in prison in 2010 in an isolated top-security wing originally built for the assassin of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. Gad Shimron is a former Mossad agent.
Censorship is something of the 20th century. In the 21st century, it is very difficult. I think cases like this, if you want to hide it away, you have to find some other ways to do it, by calling the chief editors of all the media organs in Israel to the prime minister's office and telling them, please, do not publish this story because it will harm Israel's interest. It used to work in the 20th century. In 2013, it doesn't work anymore.
And finally, the theft of a fully grown emu from an Australian wildlife park has left only a pile of feathers at the scene of the crime. Operating under cover of darkness, robbers are believed to have lifted the flightless bird, second only to the ostrich in size and known for its speed, powerful legs and clawed feet, over electrified barbed wire atop a 6.5-foot fence, eluding a guard and a security camera. And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Although I, for one, as a native of that part of the world, am baffled as to why anybody would want to steal an emu, never mind how you would steal an emu.
It's not worth very much, is it?
Well, and plus they're just foul-tempered and unpleasant, aggressive, and they eat a lot. It's not, they're not ideal pets, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Very strange. The logistics of it do intrigue me. Mm. This is not something you can sort of stuff up your jacket and then make a unless you sort of rode it to safety. If you use the actual stolen property as the getaway vehicle,
possible, isn't it?
Yeah, that could work.
Yeah.
See what you can find out. I want to know more, Jonathan. Thank you. It's nearly 7 minutes past the hour. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. This is Midori House Live from Studio One here in London with me, Andrew Muller. Now, few, if any, subjects are discussed and debated in such hypocritical tones as taxation. Broadly speaking, everyone thinks almost everyone but themselves should pay more. The consequence is endemic, systemic nodding and winking at tax evasion schemes of dazzling volume and complexity, most of which aim to help people and corporations who already have plenty of money pay even less taxes. A new plan unveiled by the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development has ambitions of changing all that. It draws particular attention to the unsporting practice whereby multinationals shunt their profits around the world in order to shield them from the taxman. Well, joining me now is Richard Murphy, founder of Tax Research UK and a chartered accountant and economist. Richard, how hard can it really be to get rich companies to pay what they owe?
I can assure you it can be very hard indeed at the present point in time. And there's a very simple explanation for that. The rules that we've now got, most of them promoted by the OECD, who've just published this report you referred to, are seriously out of date. It's like dealing with rules written in the steamship era, and we're now in the internet age, and they've ignored the fact we've been through the jet era in between.
So this is yet another case of the law being overhauled by technology?
It is exactly that at the moment. We have simply failed to keep up with the changes in globalization, the changes in technology, the changes in ethics as well. You know, it was the case, I mean, I'm old enough to remember this, that people used to be reasonably honorable in large companies. They would never have looked at some of the schemes. We reached a low, which are now done. We reached a low point around the turn of the century, I think it's fair to say, when frankly almost anything went. It's a bit better than that now, if I'm honest, in the largest companies, but we still have a major problem.
It's still more than a century since Ambrose Bierce defined the corporation as an ingenious device for securing individual profit without any individual responsibility. How would the new measures suggested by the OECD actually work?
Well, let's be clear, they haven't actually at the moment suggested any new measures. All they've set out is a potential program for work. Now, that's therefore a not very ambitious, if you want to put it like that, program. But there are some, from my point of view, encouraging signs in here. They have acknowledged that the system doesn't work. Now, for the organization that is the author of the scheme that's now not working, that's a big step forward. Until you can admit that what you've created isn't okay, you can't change it. And there's always been a reluctance to do that before.
What always baffles me about this, especially in a time of austerity, is that surely it would be at least, you know, politically expedient for governments which are struggling for popularity in a time of austerity to get out in front of this. I don't mean gratuitously beating up on big business for the sake of it, but just insisting that everybody pays their fair share.
I am completely staggered by this. I mean, I've done more work on researching what is called the tax gap, the difference between the amount of tax that should be collected by governments based upon the laws they've got and the amount of money they actually get than just about anybody else. So in the UK, I reckon the gap is 90 billion, but the government says it's 32 billion. In Europe, where I've done the figures, I reckon it's around €1 trillion. And worldwide, I reckon it's about $3.1 trillion. Now, that's an awful lot of money. That's about 5% of world GDP, which are totally missing. And yet, there seems to be an extraordinary reluctance by governments around the world to go out there and actually get this cash. And that in itself is a cause for research, because nobody knows why politically it appears to be so difficult for governments to actually get up off their backsides and say, hey, hang on, we want you to pay what you owe us.
Well, the argument against that, or at least the apology for it that's always advanced, is that if you actually make a multinational company pay what it owes, then that multinational company might well just fold its tents and therefore not contribute anything to your tax coffers, not employ any of your people, and take its business elsewhere. Does that argument actually hold up, or would a government be actually quite well advised to say to one of them, all right, then fine, clear off, see if we care?
That argument does not hold up. That's the simple point about that. I mean, I've got a book coming out on Monday, shameless plug, Here and Under Taxed. Sorry, you invited me on.
It's perfectly all right.
But the point about that is I'm, you know, exploring the companies that have been investigated recently in the UK, Google, Amazon and Starbucks. Now, Google and Amazon in particular are very good examples of companies who are clearly trying not to pay tax in some countries where they have very large operations. The UK is a perfect example of that, but so is France, so is Germany and others, and indeed right around the world. But where they do nonetheless have very quite significant physical presences. You know, the UK operation of Google is bigger than the UK operation of Ireland, but all the profit is recorded in Ireland. Now, will they leave the UK market? Will they leave the French market or the Indian market or the Australian market? Because those governments turn around and say, the price of trading in our country is paying tax here. No, they won't. And I'll tell you why they won't leave. Very simply and very straightforwardly, there's money to be made in those markets. And rational companies who are pursuing profit maximization on behalf of their shareholders don't turn down the opportunity to make profit just because they have to pay tax on it. So we have timid governments who fail to cooperate to actually take on multinational corporations and make them pay the price for that privilege of limited liability, which you referred to just now, which is the operating fee in exchange for the benefit of not being responsible for your debts, and that's tax.
Is that just... Does there need to be a measure of international cooperation? Does every country in the world need to be on board here, or could it be as simple as just one prime minister of one country just saying, seriously, cough up or clear off?
Look, there are undoubtedly advantages to international cooperation. There are some things which will work better because, for example, one of the things that is being abused is something called the concept of permanent establishment. That's where two countries have to agree which will tax a company on a transaction. Now, that's governed by 3,000 international agreements at the moment, all of which, without exception, the OECD admits are now seriously out of date and all need updating. There's obviously got to be international cooperation to change those. But that doesn't mean to say that everything has to be done at an international level. There are lots of measures, and actually I do outline them in this book I've just got coming out, which can be done at individual country levels to tackle the problems of both tax avoidance, which is what large companies do, by the way, and tax evasion, which I'm afraid to say is largely done by smaller companies and individuals. Both are problems. Actually, tax evasion is a bigger problem than tax avoidance by scale, but both are big issues. You can start locally. You can take the issue on in each individual country. But to beat multinational corporations, I'm afraid to say there is no doubt that international cooperation is the best route eventually to solving the problem.
What if any kind of power do consumers in these countries have?
I am always bemused as to how to answer that question, and I don't change that because you've just asked me. That's my hesitation. Look, it's easy in the case of a company like Starbucks, which actually is not the most serious tax avoider of all time. Let's be totally honest, it clearly has undertaken some activities which have drawn a lot of attention to itself. And it's a consumer-facing organization, which it's very easy to pass by the front door in the UK and go and find somewhere else. In the case of some other companies, yeah, and if we're talking, for example, about downloading an e-book, and you've got the choice of Amazon and Apple and only one or two others, all of whom are probably involved in some way, or the majority of whom will be involved in some way, in profit-shifting activities because the books are almost invariably downloaded from some form of tax haven location, you've got very little choice that you can bring to bear on the situation. So there is, unfortunately, not too much that most consumers can do. I'd love to say there's an obvious consumer boycott process that could take place. I'm involved in actually doing research on the UK retail sector to see which companies are better or worse. I'm afraid to say that's rather depressing research. I can tell you that now, because there aren't many who really come out with stunningly good results. A couple stand out from the crowd, but not many, and that's going to come out in a couple of months, I suspect. But overall, the consumer is faced with some pretty dismal choices of companies who, frankly, all seem to be, well, the vast majority of whom seem to be involved in some form of tax avoidance activity and are not willing, and this is the critical point, not willing to be really open and accountable about what they're doing and where. And because they won't tell us what they're doing and where, we must have some reasonable doubt as to what they're up to.
Richard Murphy, accountant, economist, founder of Tax Research UK, new book out on Monday. Thank you very much for joining us. Coming up on Midori House, months after the White House itself was successfully targeted by computer hackers, President Barack Obama signs an executive order bolstering America's online defences. But will it work? Stay tuned.
From a breed of Italian sheep brought back from extinction to vintage recipes revitalizing the dairy business in a remote part of Norway, Monocle Films brings you inspiring tales of mountain producers on a mission.
Mikhail's restaurants depend on locally sourced produce for its recipes, which have attracted a faithful following. It's proof, if ever proof were needed, that when restaurants work in collaboration with local food producers, it's possible to make a sustainable business out of organic farming and to create a distinct regional culinary identity.
Making it work in the mountains on monocle.com.
Ambitious architects, best-in-show builders, concrete connoisseurs, density designers, energy evangelists, friendly foxes, guerrilla gardeners, high-minded historians, inspirational investors, jaded janitors, Kmart killjoys, low-rise lovers, mighty mayors, naughty nocturnalists, office block occupiers, plotting planners, quietness questers, rebels and reactionaries, spick-and-span street sweepers, transport theorists, urbane urbanists, visiting visionaries, wily wayfinders, exemplary exiles, you and yours, and zero-emission zealots. For a full A to Z of the people who make our metropolises rattle along like a well-designed subway and occasionally screech to halt like one too, listen to The Urbanist, the show about the cities we live in, presented by me, Andrew Tuck. It premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. That's The Urbanist, the show for people who know that the countryside is for softies and that it doesn't matter if you can't find two words beginning with X.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, on Monocle 24. If there was any doubt about the urgency of protecting government computer networks, which there really wasn't, they were dispelled last October when an unclassified network inside the White House itself was breached by hackers. Unsurprisingly, the White House itself is approaching the subject now with a renewed seriousness. President Barack Obama has signed an executive order aimed at protecting America's critical computer infrastructure from virtual marauders. Well, joining me now to wonder whether it will work is Eric Chapman, who's the Deputy Director at Maryland Cybersecurity Center. Eric, first of all, what does Obama's order mean practically?
Practically, it's, you know, practically what's in play here is that the president has recognized that through congressional inaction over the last 6, 12, 18 months, he's been forced to do something. And what he's been forced to do is say to the American people, which he did last night, is that our nation's critical infrastructure is at risk. And whether or not this is effective, you know, his executive order is effective, will really be, you know, the devil will be in the details. Will the private sector, the owners and operators of the nation's critical infrastructure, agree to these voluntary measures? That's really where, you know, the crux of this order will be found.
Do you think this issue is taken seriously enough, not necessarily by the American government, but by the American people, and I guess by the citizens of the entire first world? Or do you think people sort of tune this out as a kind of ongoing Y2K thing?
I think that you've hit on something there, and I think that overall the level of knowledge and understanding about the sophistication of the threats that exist is not nearly where it should be for the broader American public, at least, and probably for the broader global public, indeed. I think that people are broadly unaware of, you know, what constitutes an advanced persistent threat, how hackers can, you know, surreptitiously enter your email, how you can be spoofed and fooled into clicking on malicious links that will, you know, download malware onto not only your computer, but possibly be able to spread throughout the rest of your network. So now, education and awareness is a very, very big deal that I don't think any government right now is doing enough on.
In terms of threats from hackers to not just individuals, but to governments and to the critical infrastructure that President Obama is trying to protect, what's actually the worst that could happen?
I mean, you could have a nation state who, you know, would really like to shut down the stock exchange. You could have a nation state who'd want to shut down the power grids. You could have a nation state who'd want to close a dam. You know, the former Director of National Intelligence, Mike McConnell, said a sophisticated cyber attack on our nation's power grid or financial infrastructure could cause an order of magnitude greater of damage than the 9/11 attacks did. Now, that's something that should give our lawmakers and our constituents pause, and I think it has. But I just don't think that Congress right now is too toxic of an environment to get a meaningful piece of national security legislation accomplished. And I think that's what ultimately caused the president to take this executive step.
There have been concerns raised, certainly by hacker groups, since it became clear that the president was going to sign this order, that there may be civil liberties implications. Do you think there are?
Yeah, I read the executive order and I've scoured the news. You know, I think when it comes down to civil liberties, the question really is as follows. Is the government going to be looking at the third and fourth lines of your email? No, of course not. What they're looking for is to try and, you know, take out the piece of malware that has been inserted into a network, remove it, and try and do so in the way that, you know, as least invasive as possible. This isn't about civil liberties and privacy. This is about keeping the country safe.
There's something about this kind of dynamic between governments and corporations and, I guess, hackers of various sorts that reminds me a little bit of the dynamic of, you know, what's called now asymmetrical warfare, where the great big lumbering state Leviathan is always going to be at least a couple of paces behind the nimble, quick-moving guerrillas. Is cybersecurity basically, by definition, a losing battle?
Oh, I mean, in its present form, cybersecurity is a game of whack-a-mole. I mean, we are whacking each threat that gets by our network in hopes that we're getting out the most vicious threat that we can. All the while, there are still other threats that are getting through. And every time we're successful in remediating one threat, there's another one that's going to get through. It takes about 100 lines of code to successfully write an attack. Okay? It takes about 10 million lines of code to write a program. The advantage lies inherently in the attacker. There's anonymity, there's low cost, and it's not that difficult to write, you know, a piece of malware.
And on that sobering note, Eric Chapman, Deputy Director at the Maryland Cybersecurity Center, thank you very much for your time. You're listening to Midori House. In the last couple of weeks, the world has been able to enjoy the relief of a hearty guffaw at Iran's claims of technological progress, what with their shape-shifting space monkey and a stealth fighter with a top speed of Photoshop 3. It would, however, be unwise to forget that Iran's nuclear program is ongoing and serious, and the International Atomic Energy Agency is back in Iran today to determine how ongoing and how serious. Herman Nakats, the Deputy Director of the IAEA, is the man tasked with convincing Iranian officials to allow access to the remote military base of Parchin, where it is suspected bomb triggers have already been tested. But will mounting international pressure be enough to force Iran to reassess the question of allowing access to its facilities? Well, earlier Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield spoke to Sasan Aglani, research assistant at Chatham House. He asked how the IAEA inspectors prize access out of the Ayatollahs.
Well, I think it's important not to fall into the same traps that the IAEA has previously with regards to, in particular, the Parchin military complex. It has previously framed this as a matter of principle that it deserves access to this particular facility. Iran has countered quite predictably, saying that it doesn't have the authority to actually go in under the terms of the non-proliferation treaty, and that this would even go beyond the additional protocol. So it's important to go beyond the idea that this is somehow an obligation and view it as a measure of an assurance that Iran could take to reassure the international community.
And how interested is Iran in reassuring the international community? I mean, particularly when we've got elections coming up there in June, a lot of the rhetoric from all Iranian leaders, not just Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, is very much sort of anti this idea that the international community, whatever that phrase means to them, has any right whatsoever to come to Iran and inspect their nuclear facilities.
Well, I am hopeful in terms of the fact that early indications coming from Tehran indicate that Iran would be willing to admit inspections in the Parchin military complex. And I think it's important when we view, for instance, recent comments by the Supreme Leader that Iran won't negotiate bilaterally with the US on this particular issue if a gun is held to Iran, so to speak. If we view this within the context where Iran has previously, or quite recently, indicated that there are no red lines in terms of negotiations, and that this was followed up by increased sanctions. So we have to view any sort of belligerence on behalf of the Iranians within this context, I think.
I'm intrigued as to how these inspections actually work. When we look at the inspections in Iraq in the run up to the Iraq War in 2003, there was lots of stories of Hans Blix leading his team to various different places, getting up very early in the morning and bombing off into the desert to try and find somewhere before the Iraqis knew that that's where they were going to. How much of it is like that secret surprise inspections, and how much is sort of working out beforehand, well, look, these are the facilities we'd like to go to, and arranging times to do it like that?
Well, I think previous inspections in Parchin in 2005, they were conducted on one particular site out of four. And at the time, the IAEA found no evidence of nuclear weapons production or any sort of programs related to that. They came back later and said that they'd like to view subsequent different sites within Parchin. The Iranians have come back and said that, well, you've seen what we're willing to show you at the moment.
It's interesting looking at how this works politically as well, because you've got a situation where the IAEA isn't just trying to satisfy itself about what Iran is doing, but it also has to satisfy the US and certain European countries as well, that they feel that that Iran is doing what they think they're doing. How difficult is that likely to be? I mean, if the IAEA come back and say, guys, it's fine, we looked at everything, no problems, is the US going to accept that?
Well, it's important that we view these current talks ongoing in Tehran as a sort of precursor to the talks in Kazakhstan, the negotiations that are going to be going on then between the P5 plus one and Iran. So I think
That's the permanent five members of the
US
Security Council. Yep.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, if we view this these current talks with the IAEA within that context, where if an agreement on the technical side of the nuclear program are sort of ironed out and that it can form the basis of more of a structured program or deal or package that could be put to Iran, where it might be willing to put a cap on its enrichment program in exchange for, you know, stuff such as sanction relief and the recognition of its right to enrichment. There are additional things that Iran will be called upon to implement, obviously, but this is just one way we can view the current talks.
And just finally and briefly, when we look at, you know, these inspections and then the talks you mentioned in Kazakhstan at the end of this month, is essentially what we're trying to do here, keep the show on the road. So long as there are inspections, as long as there are talks or even talks about talks, then everyone will be sort of pretty much happy.
I think so. And I think the point is if the idea of more inspections in Parchin, if this is linked to the prospect of a package to be put to Iran, which it is actually, you know, putting serious proposals on the table at the moment. It has done in the past as well, but there have been stopgaps. If this is actually linked with that, then I think there is elements of optimism there.
And that was Steve Bloomfield speaking to Sasan Aglani at Chatham House. In the next half hour on Pandori House, we will meet Will Storr, author of a new book which asks why people believe the stuff they believe, even and especially when everyone else thinks, usually quite rightly, that they're entirely mad. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. Local officials have said that a NATO airstrike has killed 10 Afghan civilians, including 5 children, in eastern Afghanistan today, a toll that, if confirmed, is likely to raise tension between President Hamid Karzai's government and US-led NATO forces. Here, raids by British police and regulators on 2 companies suspected of selling horse meat as beef have expanded a Europe-wide scandal that has shocked consumers and exposed flawed food safety controls. A Tibetan youth dressed as a monk poured petrol over his body and set himself alight at a temple in Kathmandu as an apparent protest against Chinese rule of his Himalayan homeland. The European Commission President José Manuel Barroso said today that the European Union and the United States were set to begin negotiating a groundbreaking free trade agreement. And the mysterious death of an Australian prisoner in Israel has put the spotlight on a military-run censorship system there. ABC Australia claimed that the dead man was a member of Israel's Mossad spy agency. That's the news from Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, that peerless chronicler of the human condition, H.L. Mencken, once noted that the curse of man and the cause of almost all his woes is his stupendous capacity for believing the incredible. Certainly, the decades since the Sage of Baltimore made this observation have offered little in the way of refutation. It is arguable, indeed, that the modern world is more burdened by unreason than any period in human history, thanks to the connective potence of the internet, the speed at which information travels, and the ability of any dingbat with a laptop to compete for the same screen space as the Encyclopedia Britannica. None of which quite explains the animating fervour of deniers, revisionists, cranks and conspiracists. The journalist Will Storr has thought about this more than most. His new book, The Heretics, chronicles his encounters with those who believe the unbelievable, and he joins me now. Will, welcome to the show. First of all, I wanted to ask, in the manner of a confession, I've occasionally thought of writing a book much like this myself, but was put off the idea because I wasn't sure how far into my research I'd get before I hit somebody. How big a test of your patience was this?
Well, my patience was tested at the very, very beginning, actually, when I met my first heretic, which is John Mackay. He was a very big figure on the international creationism scene. And it was when I was talking, he was insisting to me that gay people are going to go to hell because it says in the Bible that, you know, a man shouldn't lie with a man. And I kind of made the obvious kind of observation that, you know, homosexuality can't be a sin because it's not a choice. You know, you're tempted to steal, but you're not tempted to kind of, you know, be gay. You're born gay. And he said, oh, no, you're wrong about that. You know, no, you're not born gay. It's something the devil tempts you into. And I said, no, John. you know, it's pretty clear that, you know, people are born gay. You know, we know this is kind of, you know, not really a debatable fact. And he said, well, it may appear that way, but it only appears that way because the Satan has persuaded you that this is the case. And it's like, you can't argue with that. You know, this is a guy that claims to be a scientist, you know, but in his worldview, any evidence at all that he's confronted with that runs counter to his belief in you know, the Old Testament version of Christianity, he just dismisses as a lie by Satan. And it's just, you know, it's so frustrating.
Well, but this is exactly the point. And you're quite right. You literally cannot argue with these people. So what means of relating with them did you manage to contrive?
Well, I mean, I suppose what I did was I did a lot of research into some of the more sort of incredible findings of experimental psychology and neuroscience that we've had over the last sort of 10, 15 years. And then you begin to see how, you know, people like John Mackay and, you know, David Irving, the right-wing historian, and the climate change denier, Lord Monckton, who I also met, you know, you see that these are kind of extreme versions of ourselves. We all, you know, make these same mistakes. You know, we all have these same kind of biases. You know, an obvious one, which everyone knows about, is confirmation bias, in which we feel as if we're assessing evidence fairly when we're confronted with a story, say, or a set of beliefs about something like abortion. But actually, what we're doing is we are only looking for evidence and accepting evidence that justifies our initial emotional conviction on that issue. So feel like we're fair judges of evidence, but we're not. We're simply not.
Well, quite. I mean, nobody thinks, you know, I'm an irrational crank.
Exactly. I mean, it's one of those things that when someone points it out to you, it's really obvious. But to me, it was a revelation. You know, our biases are invisible to us. So none of us, you know, we all feel as if we're not the prejudiced ones. We're not the biased ones. That's everybody around us. You know, we have a very reasonable and evidence-based view of the world. And of course, everybody believes like that. You know, David Irving looked me in the eye and said, I am not an anti-Semite. And then the next breath started, you know, talking about how Jews have got something different in their brains. I mean, he believes he's not an anti-Semite, genuinely, sincerely, because he thinks he's reached his judgment and conclusion by a fair assessment of the evidence. An anti-Semite implies he's made a mistake. And, you know, so it's, you know, this is just, it was quite an astonishing moment, but of course we're all like this in a way.
Your book covers ground that other writers have tinkered with, at the very least, thinking of specifically books like John Ronson's Them and David Aronovich's Voodoo Histories, both of which are also absolutely excellent books. How does yours differ from theirs?
Well, I mean, and I'm a big fan of both of those books, but what I wanted to do was actually find an answer. So rather than just sort of looking at these sort of a series of interesting case studies and exploring them and kind of pointing out maybe where some of the logic has gone wrong, I went very, very deeply into the, you know, the science of belief. And so there's two long chapters on, you know, the actual mechanisms in the brain, the psychological flaws we have, which lead to all these beliefs. So hopefully it's a much deeper, and I actually come up with an answer at the end. I've got a theory, and it's called the Hero Maker. And the theory is we all live our lives as if we're the heroes in a kind of narrative of good and evil, a kind of an emotional narrative of the kind of that you'd see in a film or a good book. And it's that story that we tell of our lives, is that story that we tell of the world and our place within it, which underlies all our false beliefs. So if we're confronted by a new idea, if it concords with our, you know, hero narrative that we make of the world, then we tend to accept it. But if it goes against it, we won't. So Lord Monckton is a perfect example. I mean, he's a climate change denier, you know, in a way. I mean, he accepts that man-made climate change is real, but he's insistent that it's not going to have a deleterious effect upon mankind. And underneath this belief, this scientific belief or quasi-scientific belief, there's an incredibly phantasmagorical worldview he has, in which there's a conspiracy by the left, and there has been for decades, which is trying to take over the world. And he believes that climate scientists are involved in this plot to institute one world government because the left is inherently totalitarian. And that explains, I mean, and so his hero narrative is he's this great, you know, David versus Goliath fight that he's involved with against these powerful forces of the left, which are trying to take over the world. And so that's why, you know, if you try and debate him on science, he's never going to accept a point of fact about science, because as far as he's concerned, it's all a conspiracy. And any bit of science. I mean, a bit like the creationist who says that it's Satan. Any bit of science that might go against what he believes is just, you know, it's made up. It's a lie. It's part of this scheme.
Do you think that these kind of beliefs have anything? Because this is the thought that's occurred to me in my occasional interactions with the fanatical. Do you think this has anything in common with religious faith? I mean, isn't God just the ultimate conspiracy theory?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in the epilogue of my book, which is where I kind of describe my idea of the hero maker, you know, I look into the history of storytelling and what sort of literary theorists and academics who are interested in story believe about, you know, the idea of story. And they think that, you know, in the early days, that story was the first form of science. It was the way that we explained how we came to be here, you know, the origin of the world. And it's the way, you know, we all have naturally, you know, occurring moral impulses. You know, we might feel revulsion if we think about incest, for example. So, you know, early religions, not only they explained the creation of the world and our place within it, but they also explained these kind of moral impulses. It's not, you know, this feeling is, you know, God says this is bad. And so, religion really is a very, very complex explanation of cause and effect, which is what the brain does. You know, it generates stories to explain cause and effect. It's not bothered particularly whether those stories are true, but it has this compulsion to explain the world.
Will Storr, thank you very much for joining us. That was Will Storr, author of the absolutely tremendous book, The Heretics, Adventures with the Enemies of Science, which is out now or now about us. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with some music.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. If you haven't listened to this week's edition of Robert Bound's Culture Show yet, you absolutely should look it up on our website or on iTunes, because it contains, among much else, a session and an interview with none other than Steve Earle, who came in here last week and played four songs in our cafeteria, of which this was one. This is the title track from his new album, The Low Highway.
Traveling out on the low highway, 3,000 miles to the Frisco Bay, across the rivers wild and the lonesome plains, up a coast and down, back again. I saw empty houses on dead-end streets, people lining up against something to eat, and the ghost of America watching me through the broken windows in the factories. Naked bones of a better day as I rode down the low highway. Traveling on the low highway by the yellow moon and a light day, a snow white crown on the mountaintop to the valley down where the shadows fall. I met a man with a rifle in his hand. Been away to battle in a distant land. I taught him to hate, taught him to kill. Eyes out on the road with a hole to fill. Nobody knows the price he paid, so it's taking its toll on the low highway. Every sound is a prophecy. Heard an old man grumble, a young girl cry. A brick wall crumble, a white dove fly. A call for justice and a cry for peace. A voice of reason and the roar of the beast. Every mile was a prayer I prayed as I rode down the low highway.
That was none other than Steve Earle with the title track from his new album, The Low Highway, recorded live here at Midori House. You can hear the rest of that session and an interview in the current edition of Robert Bowne's Culture Show, available on the website or on iTunes. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, the race for the Golden Bear is now very much on as this year's Berlin Film Festival nears its finale, at which point we should probably mention that the imminent print edition of Monocle magazine is a Germany special which has a more edible sort of Golden Bear on its cover. However, that's on a newsstand near you, but with us from Berlin right now is Monocle's executive producer, Gillian de Bias. Gillian, good evening.
Hello and greetings from a very cold Berlin, Andrew. It's freezing here.
It's not all that balmy in London either, if that's any consolation. First of all, what are you actually doing in Berlin?
Well, I feel very lucky to be here because the energy is fantastic because it is the Berlin Film Festival. But I'm here doing two films to coincide with our Germany special that's coming out very soon. So I'm doing one film and we're looking at the whole kind of new pulse of the contemporary art scene here in Berlin. And then the second film I'm going to do is looking at the German film industry, but kind of as it's reflected in this year's Berlinale, the Berlin Film Festival.
And what impressions are you getting of the film festival so far?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Having covered a lot of other festivals before, it's kind of like it complements all the other festivals in that it's the smart, intellectual, ideas-driven film festival, which I find quite refreshing, and it makes up for the fact that it's freezing cold, unlike Cannes, which is balmy, and you're walking in palm trees and along as your water. But so there's a definitely feel that this is where you discover some of the more, I mean, art house would be a bit unfair to say. It's not quite art house films, but some of the more influential niche films, interesting films that are going to make their way around the world in the year to come. So it's so far being quite quiet in terms of there haven't been too many films that have really excited people in the competition, except for one, which is a Chilean film called Gloria, which everyone is very excited by, and there's kind of a rush for distributors to pick it up for global distribution.
I mean, away from the festival, what kind of impression are you getting of Berlin itself? There's a slightly, possibly slightly pseudish perception that it's kind of over, that all the sort of interesting people who moved there 10 years ago when the rents were really cheap have now been priced out of it.
Well, I think there is some truth to that. I'm lucky that I'm getting my own personal guided tour by our Berlin correspondent, Kimberly Bradley, who really knows the scene so well. So she's guiding me through it. And I think, you know, there was such a kind of cool to all the East Berlin scene that was happening. And I think that's calmed down, quietened down. Some people are moving on to other German cities. But the really good gallerists are creating new homes, making galleries that are really stand out and that people come to in part because of the spaces that they're creating their galleries in. And these are real buildings that have had a past and had a history. And what I find refreshing are the complete opposite to the trend of the kind of white cubes that have been so popular for contemporary art for a while.
So what kind of places have you seen that have really impressed you?
Oh, well, I mean, for me as a filmmaker, it's been a dream to film in them because, I mean, just to give you an example, there's the old printing presses from the Tagesspiegel when they closed down and moved out. That's Berlin's newspaper. The empty cavernous space with almost like cathedral glass ceilings has now been turned into a gallery. There's a wonderful, very, I found quite kind of sad, almost like ghosts in it. It's an old Jewish girls' school that has had various incarnations since the war, but has now been given a new life. And it's a gallery space and cafes, but it's beautifully, beautifully done. And that is in the East Berlin area. And then yesterday we filmed in this incredible, almost ugly, but bullet, brutalist 60s church that one of Berlin's best gallerist, Johann Koenig, has just taken over. He's so far just, it's still a bit of a building site, but he's going to take that over for his new gallery for contemporary art and contemporary sculpture. And that space, it just, you know, you can really feel the emotional impact of this kind of raw church. And I'm quite excited to see what kind of art, when it does finally open, it will be exhibiting.
And we look forward to what results. Monocle's executive producer, Gillian de Bias, in Berlin. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Time now for our daily monologue, and today we turn to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Steve perceives a link between Boeing's problems keeping its 787s airborne and the difficulties British food retailers are having keeping Grand National losers out of their hamburgers. Has outsourcing gone mad?
An abattoir in Bucharest and a battery manufacturer in Kyoto. One was the source of the horse meat, which appears to have turned up in pretty much every cheap beef dish in Britain. The other was the company responsible for the failing batteries in Boeing's new Dreamliner. The brouhaha over burgers and Boeing may appear to be entirely unconnected, but they have one important factor in common. Both of these problems have been created by outsourcing. From call centres in India to textile factories in China, outsourcing was once capitalism's big idea. Its proponents argued that products should be made as cheaply as possible. Where they were made was irrelevant. Throughout the 1990s and long into this century, outsourcing was king. Millions of jobs in the US, Britain, and throughout Western Europe moved east. Slowly, though, the tide has turned. Consumers wanted to know where the products they were buying actually came from. Smart companies realised there was money to be made by keeping quality standards high. Understanding and controlling every part of the supply chain has become vital once again. Reshoring is an ugly word, but it's one filled with hope. Companies that outsourced are now bringing jobs home again, with big-name American white goods manufacturers and small trench coat designers in Northern England alike. There's an understanding that manufacturing needs to take place as close to home as possible. We talk about the made-in label a lot here at Monocle, and here's where we return to burgers and Boeing. The British supermarkets filling their freezers with cheap beef products had no idea what was in their burgers and lasagnas because they weren't made in Britain. Boeing didn't immediately know how to fix the problem with their batteries because they weren't made in Everett. They're not merely outsourcing labour, they're outsourcing responsibility. And there is another enemy of modern-day capitalism that will help solve this problem: regulation. The Food Standards Agency in Britain, once eagerly lined up for the chop by David Cameron as an example of the overbearing nanny state, is now likely to find its oversight role expanded. While in the US, the Federal Aviation Authority has ensured that the Dreamliner's slow return to the air will be safe. Its very presence gives passengers and airlines the confidence that the problems will be solved before anyone gets on a 787 again. So whether it's aviation or agriculture, there is nothing wrong with making your products with pride while an independent body ensures that no one gets hurt. For Monocle, I'm Steve Bloomfield.
And that was Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, with his thoughts on outsourcing. It's time for one more song before the top of the hour. This is Wild Bell with It's Too Late. That was Wild Bell with It's Too Late. And that's all we have time for on this edition of Midori House. Thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Barbara Feeney, and our studio manager, Toby Hammer. Next up is The Entrepreneurs, where in a couple of reports from France, we'll find out about one of the oldest candle makers in the world and how an e-newsletter has been revealing the best-kept secrets of Paris.
Sometimes it can be an address in Paris, it can be a restaurant, but it also can be where, you know, where in Paris you have the best sunset view in the entire city.
3 hours from now, at 2200 hours here in London, Ted Kravitz and Phil Hahn will be back for the Monocle Daily, and Steve Bloomfield will be your host on Midori House at the same time tomorrow. For now, though, I've been Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening. Good night.